Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
London, where I live, we live near the river, and we were just hoping that Reading did the decent thing and broke its banks in order to save Chiswick being flooded. All heart, aren't we?
So Reading,
so altruistic.
Reading took a bullet for Chiswick.
Took a bullet. They fell on their own sword so that the good burghers of Chiswick could pad around without the gumboots on.
When London floods, do you know what's the bit that's going to be above the water?
Well, hopefully Penton Hill, where
we are, actually.
Which is
one of the highest bits of London.
Local.
No, Harrow on the Hill is the place.
Well, again, there's a clue in the title.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
You've been up there.
So that's higher than Hampstead Heath and...
I think it probably is. If you go up via Harrow, near Harrow School, you occasionally get glimpses between the buildings where you get an absolute panorama of London below you, but you can't catch much of it, but, you know,
it's the place to be on the top of the Shard. Yeah, the view.
You've discovered the Shard, haven't you?
Yeah, I've discovered the Shard because...
Tell us about the Shard.
Everyone's been talking about this building, which is going to be completed before the Olympics in 2012. And it's going to be the highest building in Europe. And I just didn't notice. I've just been looking out the way because we've got a 30-mile view, as listeners probably know, because I'm always going on about it, from the Word office. We can see right at Canary Wharf, right around to Chelsea Harbour, and all points I can see as far as Guildford. And I've suddenly noticed this building because it's appeared from behind a what we used to call skyscraper in the 60s. And it's now come out from behind that, and I can now see it. And it's just growing by the day. It is massive. And it's going to be something like 1.5 times the height of NatWest Tower. That's pretty amazing,
but
isn't it?
But it's pointy, isn't it?
It looks like a shard. Yeah. It's a shard.
It's like they've got a pointy building in San Francisco, haven't they?
I
think.
But they probably didn't have a jokey name for it. We've been very duffed up in the international press. Apparently, when the British get a new building, they have to call it the cheese grater or the gherkin.
Oh, really?
They can't, apparently they just can't say it's the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building. They've got to call it, you know, the carrot or the stick of celery or something.
Or something with the word
fountain.
Or word canary in there.
Exactly, yeah.
They probably think that's a joke.
See, yeah.
They probably think that name was made up by scriptwriters.
Or Canary Wharf, yes. That's just not exactly.
Like Monty Python.
That's a nickname. Canary Wharf. Oh, that's brilliant.
I think it's everyone does it, though. I know the rugby stadium in Wellington, New Zealand is referred to as the Cape Tin.
Oh, is it? Right, OK. Well, Americans are obviously slightly more respectful.
The Chinese call the Olympic Stadium...
The Bird's Nest.
The Bird's Nest.
The Bird's Nest, exactly. So it's not
Which,
just
to
us.
Be fair, it did look like
Well, it was
like
designed
nest.
To look like a bird's nest.
Yeah.
Is this the Word podcast?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yeah, we are.
And we've started. I'm David Hepworth, and you're who?
Fraser Lurie.
And you're who?
I'm Mark Ellen.
Right, we're fully gathered to follow up issues of burning
issues.
To the massive and
import.
Beyond. Yes, yes. Big news this week. I suppose my question was, is it big news? The White Stripes... Knock it on the head. They decide. I think they've had a sort of three. I think they've had a 3 or 4 year period of not really doing anything White Stripes wise, but now they've officially confirmed that's it for the moment.
And was anybody getting up in the morning going, "Oh, I hope the old White Stripes come back together"?
Well, that was my question. It's as if the sort of the media is programmed to regard groups splitting up as being really dramatic news. And I just wonder whether it is anymore. whether anybody's
in the case of the White
really
Stripes,
bothered.
I didn't know that. It can't possibly be. It can't be, because Jack White has nothing that fill the long gaps between White Stripes records with huge numbers of projects, isn't he? I mean, indefatigable, tireless.
The raconteurs,
yeah,
and
yeah.
The Dead Weather, is
Dead
that
weather?
One?
Yeah, exactly.
It seems to pop up on everything.
This new Rome project.
Rome,
too.
Exactly.
No, film with Jimmy Page, yeah. and The Hedge.
Is it not true that bands only break up on the way down unless they're interrupted by death?
Well, that's an interesting theory. Go on, stand that
completely
up for us.
Completely correct, Fraser.
Well, I think if
there's
you're
no
a band on the
here.
Way up, you don't split up. It's as simple as that. Life is getting better, and so you stay as you are.
I totally agree with that.
I'm now going to think, trying to see
no,
how to think
surely,
of an exception. People leave occasionally when bands are on the way up, but they don't break up. The rest of them will keep together.
No, they don't break up, but if, I suppose the Beatles being the best example, if the creative engine is working and appears to be dependent on the dynamic of the various core members, no, people will survive the most unbelievable amounts of personal misery and discord in order to make the great records. Once they stop making the great records, or the public don't consider to be the great records anymore commercially, then I think it starts to fall apart. Because I agree with you. I mean, I can only... I was thinking of, Nirvana. But they broke up because somebody died.
Yep.
Joy Division broke up because somebody died. I mean, they could have made, I'm sure, a lot more interesting records. I mean, Fleetwood Mac as the blues band. Actually, they did go on for quite a long time, but they were absolutely...
Well, no, they had many different
actually,
phases.
Somebody almost sort of died.
They restarted Fleetwood Mac on...
No, but
three
that,
occasions.
I'm thinking of the great lineup with Peter Green, but actually Peter Green was invalided out, so it's exactly your point.
And Jeremy Spencer had left around about the same time, hadn't they? No, slightly before. And then they sort of started again with a new front.
Yeah.
And that lasted for about 10 years. Then they got rid of that new front and got another new front end.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fleetwood Mac, rare example of a group who've managed to reform on the basis of the same rhythm section.
Yeah, that's the
all the people at the front wrote the songs and sang lead, changed. Yeah. The bit at the back didn't.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. But anyway,
probably
going back to...
owned the name Fleetwood Mac.
So, yes. So going back to your point then about bands not breaking up on the way up, only doing it on the way down, does that suggest that when bands break up, what they're really doing is confessing there's nothing left in the tank? That they've sat there and they go, there are no terrific songs.
Or they can't bear the thought of being less popular than they once were.
Oh, okay.
I think it's my theory that the grief and misery outweighs the satisfaction. Because the satisfaction, and it's like, it's like McCartney and Lennon recording, the Ballad of John and Yoko, at the point where they absolutely detested each other the most. He still rang up McCartney and said, would you come down to Abbey Road tomorrow at 9 o'clock? And for 4 hours, they recorded all the parts.
And record this song, having a go at you.
I'm going to write a song released on the Apple label about how shit you are. And how terrific my new girlfriend
is. Yeah, can you come at 10 o'clock?
Hey, 10 o'clock.
Don't be late.
No money in it. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's
apart from the Pixies, maybe the Pixies. I'm trying to think of somebody. The Pixies probably could have kept going a bit longer, couldn't they?
Yeah, but they were on the way down. Everyone thought...
Oh, were they? Okay, maybe.
So the first thing we've got to dispose of is it's still, up until John Lennon died, this still popped up as a story on the press every 2 years. Could the Beatles reform? And I used to sit there and think, please don't. Didn't you, Mark?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody in their right mind would have wanted the Beatles to reform, would they?
No, we had Big Star then and 10cc, all the new Beatles. And the Arrows.
It was a story that was closed, wasn't it?
It was.
The kid simply couldn't be any better than it was. Why would anybody want to prolong those things? And I suppose this is the kernel of the argument, isn't it, about bands breaking up? That fans, in mourning this, are sort of hoping that the world's going to stay as it is. And it's not, is it?
It's entirely self-interested, isn't it? Isn't it people wanting to return to the place where they were happy, because the group was the soundtrack to their lives? They'd like that happiness to be reinstated, please. The only example I can think of, actually, in recent memory, of people talking about unfinished business, and I'm thinking they had a genuine point, was Blind Faith, who made, I don't think, a very good record, but they might have made some better records.
Sure.
But they actually only made one record. It was all absolutely catastrophic. And when Clapton and Winwood got together, and I think they're probably still together, and I think still playing the odd show, they described that as unfinished business. And I thought that was fair enough, actually, because obviously all those guys are just working out just combinations they can go out and still touring. that kind of generally gives themselves a lick of new pain. That seemed fair enough, because it only lasted a few months, didn't it? Less than a year?
Now, I've got two candidates. I've racked my brains to think of acts that I personally think shouldn't have broken up. One is Crowded House, because Crowded House broke up in order to let Neil Finn do his own thing. And then he slowly had to work his way back to reforming Crowded House, because
his own thing had slightly fizzled out.
Well, he wasn't distinct enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was at his best within Crowded House.
Yeah.
And there was a huge public appetite for Crowded House. And so, you know, I know that the record companies were tearing their hair out because they wanted it to be Crowded House, because they'd built it up to a point where they'd sold a lot of records and they were on the point of being, you know, a world act. You know, they could have been Coldplay big.
But the point is, it didn't sound sufficiently different from Crowded House.
No.
It was the bloke with the acoustic guitar, same voice, same lyric writer. So it's not like David Albarn's projects, which sound absolutely nothing like.
Sure.
Like the group that produced Park Life.
But they're also on stage, you know, because of the dynamic between Neil Finn and Nick Seymour and Paul Hester, they had something unique, which wasn't there anymore, you know, since it was one bloke on his own. And now that, you know, they've had to do it however many years later, 10 years later, and somebody somewhere must be kicking themselves that they didn't keep it going.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, through that time, because they pretty much had to restart at a lower level than they'd knocked it on the head.
Do you think a slice of humble pie has been consumed? Do you think they've called for the dessert trolley and asked if humble pie is possibly on the menu?
I don't think anybody would tell you that, but I can't help but think that that's the case. So that's one act.
No, that's a good example. Yeah.
The other one,
go on,
who I was reminded of when reading Joe Boyd's book. What's Joe's book called? White Bicycles?
White Bicycles.
His memoirs of the 60s. Joe Boyd, the great record producer. He talks about when he first came to Britain from the United States, and he's in his 20s, and he's a kind of talent scout. You know, he's trying to find people to sign to the Elektra label, and he's very excited to be in Britain. And, you know, psychedelia's going off in the United States. It hasn't quite gone off in the same way here. And he's looking around for people to sign. And the group that he cites as being the most exciting of all the people he saw at the time was The Move. You talk about The Move here with Roy Wood and probably with Jeff Lynne just starting
record.
To come in there.
Brilliant record.
You know, the roundabout Shazam message from the country. That time when you were getting this welding of the extraordinary pop sensibility of Roy Wood, you know, the man who'd written Fire Brigade and I Can Hear the Grass Grow and Blackberry Way and all these things, with Jeff Lynne, second genius.
Magic combination. You absolutely.
Know, and also a fantastic live act, you know, really kind of ballsy group from Birmingham who kind of they dressed up in the sort of the same effete, you know, clothing as the bands from West London.
Yeah.
But these guys, they were a kind of, you know, they were a rock and roll band, you know, that knew how to sort of handle itself in a club. And he felt that they could have been absolutely huge if they'd held together. But I don't think they were. I don't think they're particularly well managed. I think Don Arden may have been involved at that point. You know, I think they're a pretty short term view on the part of the management. But Joe Boyd feels
out of high window that, by you.
That Joe Boyd feels that if they'd stuck together, they might have been, you know, I don't know,
good point,
Cream or whatever.
Yeah, because those are incredible records.
And yeah, probably not as good as they ought to have been, really, because they never got Beatles type treatment from a record company. You know, things tended to be done rather on the cheap. But that's a rare example of a group, I think, that could have given it longer. Most of the ones that people cite, and there's been a lot of discussion.
Simon and Garfunkel. Was it going downhill when the?
There's a difference, a duo rather than.
Can't
a group,
remember those both. There's not really a group, is it? Paisley Lee Jackson. Paisley Jackson made one absolutely unbelievable.
Well, who is Paisley Lee Jackson?
Well, they were
Rod
an Australian
Stewart.
Rock band, weren't they? But I think it's probably because Rod Stewart's "In a Broken Dream" is just a masterpiece. Absolute. Enduring masterpiece.
Well, of course, but
really discovered about five
round years. About the same time, the other group who never fulfilled their potential, which Rod Stewart was also in, was the Jeff Beck group.
Yeah, absolutely.
The classic Jeff Beck group with Mickey Waller on the drums, Jeff Beck on guitar, Ron Wood on the bass, Rod Stewart singing, and I think Nicky Hopkins a lot of the time.
Steve Beckett as well. There's another one. Very brief appearance, wasn't it? Steve Beckett?
I don't really know the story of Steve Beckett, but they probably weren't together for very long.
Very short time. Yeah. Great, a real super group.
Whereas I think you know, a lot of people, you know, weighing on in on the website on the subject of this. You know, this is an interesting point made by, I can't read in here because it's dark, Fraser, but I think it's Johan. Julian, Johan, whatever I'm reading. Talking about REM. He says, and then, there are bands who hang around for too long. He says, I wish REM had split about a decade ago, maybe after Reveal, which would have been going out on a high. It's a bit sad that their imminent album will probably be greeted by a collective shrug and even lower sales than the last couple.
The drummer knew when to quit, didn't he? Or maybe the band darts are good because he has left, I don't know.
That's true.
He became a potato farmer, I think.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Is that what he does? Is
Bill, it was health, wasn't it?
It's health. He had like a brain aneurysm or something.
Yeah, he was a potato farmer.
I think he's a farmer now, yeah.
Probably enormously happy and content.
I think so,
Don't you think?
But it's extraordinary that REM have hung on so long, you know, that it now feels like the kind of afterlife of REM, doesn't it? Kind of twilight world of REM. But they've stuck together, haven't they? And they've got this new record which is coming out, you know, in a couple of weeks' time. And I've heard it. And it's really interesting in that you sit and listen to it, like I've listened to the last few, and you go, do you know, this is just like their good albums.
But not so good.
It's not good. You know, now, how does that work, Mark? You know, they've got a ballad that sounds a bit like, you know, Drive, they've got up-tempo, kind of, you know, air-punching stuff like they've done in the past. They've got sort of quirky stuff. They've got...
But don't you think a lot of
that... just not as good.
Right, but don't you think a lot of that is to do... Well, it's two things, right? One is your belief in their commitment to the songs, right? I loved REM as much as anybody, and I used to think that because they were young and because they seemed to be out there dealing with real experiences, which they broadcast in their songs, that they sort of inhabited those songs, and the songs really were a soundtrack to this kind of southern concept of REM, which is a very southern concept. It's a huge landscape of sound. I associated it with, can't remember where they're from now, Georgia? Is it Georgia?
Athens, Georgia.
And so I suppose I thought that they were, you know, that they were a living entity radiating some kind of warmth and sensibility about a world that they inhabited. In a world, I have to say, that to British people seems really, really romantic. You know, that works in reverse as well. Americans look at British groups and English groups with a great romance, and we go, they're from Reading. They're from Woking. Have you ever been to Soot City? God almighty. Don't get Paul Weller out of context, mate, you know. And but that's one thing. And the other thing is novelty. Is that they had a fantastic sound. I remember going what was it called? Was it Later with Jules Holland? Whatever the program. Yeah, well, it must be Later with Jules Holland. Yeah, and they recorded The Passenger. I went to the studio, watched them, and they were absolutely marvellous. This was quite late in the day, actually. And they still had a novelty to their sound.
Mystery rather than novelty.
And a mystery, yes, but there was a lovely sound. It was a sort of 12-string guitar sound and a particular bass sound and particular vocals. Like Mike Mills, backing vocal, actually, very underrated. But once you're used to that sound, they don't make a different sound.
No, there's a great
documentary. Do they? I mean, they've got some mandolins on occasionally, but, you know, they don't really make a different sound.
There's a really good documentary called Athens, Georgia, Inside Out, which was filmed in the mid-'80s focuses on a lot of Athens bands, and there's a B-52s and then REM, and then about 10 or 12 never got anywhere. And there's a couple of great clips of REM playing live in a church, and it is completely mysterious and magical, and they don't sound like anyone else. And it's kind of revealing that. And nowadays, you know exactly what they sound like. There's no mystery to REM. You know what the new record will sound like. And however good it is, I think that it's less of an album because of that.
You don't think there's also...
Agreed.
And I suppose this is a bit of an extension of Mark's point. That, you know, like in the cliche, when the boy's breaking up with a girl, he always says, it's not you, it's me.
You know, meaning it's you.
Well, I wonder if there's a bit of that going on in your relationship with an act like REM or anybody who's been around for ages, which is that there's a part of your head which has got a bit of a space for an REM. But that part is occupied by, perfectly happily, Automatic for the People, don't go back for Rockville, losing my religion or whatever. You've got a really strong idea of REM in your head.
Completely.
We could all now close our eyes, not say anything, and we could hear the sound of great REM records in our heads. They're in there. They've gone in there as a consequence of huge repetition over a long period of time. If anything else is going to go in there in that little place in our heads that's reserved for REM, it's got to displace one of those things, and it will never do that.
Completely.
And that, you know, the same thing applies to, you know, Bruce Springsteen or whatever. I suppose the rare exception, I can think of Bob Dylan songs made in the last 10 years that might displace, you know, like a Rolling Stone or whatever. But, you know, it's a tough call. You know, to do stuff more later in your career, which is as kind of blazing and gripping as the stuff you did earlier.
Is there one more factor, which is that, and this is going to sound like a really adolescent thing to say, but when you form those very close associations with groups, a lot of it's based on, as I said earlier, on the belief that they're on the inside of this machine and they're living this life and it's real and it's authentic. And when I was kind of, I remember being slightly heartbroken. I think I was the editor of Q magazine, so this is a long time ago, when REM came over to do some press. And we were told they're doing a press in Ireland. And I said, OK, fine. And, you know, Warner Brothers or whoever it was were going to take us over there. It's all fine. And then we discovered they're doing it in Ireland, in a castle, principally so they could play golf. And I felt a bit, it's just going to sound really, I felt disappointed. Mike Mills and Bill, and all of them apart from Michael Stipe. But then I was equally disappointed that Michael Stipe had kind of gone off to be this frightful kind of, a really bad version of Freddie Mercury's social butterfly, a kind of vampiric figure.
It's because he hung about with Patti Smith.
Anybody who hangs around with Patti Smith is just... And Courtney Love. Ruined it. Yes. You're right, Dave.
You've got great taste.
But to be fair, you know, I'm very fond of you. And if I found out that you'd been hanging around with Courtney Love, you know, I would actually have to reevaluate my first impression of it. So, you know, it was... Anyway, that let me down.
So it's very difficult to sustain, you know, the freshness in a relationship with an act that
very
has been going on for that
talking
long.
About Bill Berry going off to be a potato farmer is a lovely thing in the new issue. It's coming out next week with Bunny Whaler leaving the Whalers. And Bunny Whaler, I think probably gripped by his fervour for Rastafari, feels that any more success than the success that they've gained, it is no more success than he rightfully should earn. So he leaves to go and tend his crops. I love that idea that the rest of them are going off to stay in the, you know, in the inn on the park, you know, and rack up an enormous, you know, tab. And he's gone back to water his crops.
Do you think Buddy might have a particular interest in one crop?
It's
monoculture.
But that crop, I think, monoculture. Yes, I'm sure even backstage he's probably had a few polytunnels set up.
Talking to Bunny Whaler, Fraser and I went to a preview of a film last week, didn't we?
Which Fire in Babylon.
No, it's not. It's called Blood and Fire. It's called Blood and Fire, isn't it? I think it's called Blood and Fire.
Okay.
You would never know from that title or from the branding of it or the advertising or anything. This is actually a film, and a pretty good one, about the great West Indian cricket team of the late 70s and early 80s. You know, the great fast bowlers and Malcolm Marshall and, you know, Viv Richards and Clive Lloyd were the captains, and they terrorised, you know, the batsmen all over the world. And it's about the kind of, you know, the relationship between the rise in cricket and the rise in kind of West Indian pride, and it ties in music and so forth. And Bunny Whaler pops up to be interviewed about this. And he's extraordinary looking, isn't he?
He is extraordinary looking.
What does he look like now?
Well, he's wearing what looks like something that's been taken from Kim Jong-il's wardrobe.
It's a safari suit, isn't it? Yes, and with a huge great hat to kind of secrete his locks under there. But he also looks terribly well turned now, doesn't he?
Yes.
He looks as if he's gone to, you know, Rastas R Us style academy or whatever before he's interviewed back a yard, you know. And
that's a lovely idea. He's got dressed up. I mean, but the man is surely, to some extent, still feeding chickens, isn't he? Like, does he feed chickens in a belted safari suit, but lightly flared?
The best stuff is where he stops talking about Malcolm Marshall and Curtly Ambrose and so forth. And because there's some kids making a row in the background, aren't they? And he suddenly lapses into absolute impenetrable patois. you know, basically saying,
get the message.
Basically saying the jar equivalent of, you know, I know where you live. Play around your own backyard, sunshine, you know. And because they leave the camera running while he's doing this. And it's priceless comedy, isn't it? It's a pretty good film if you're into cricket. Now, I thought that yesterday I'd had a major epiphany with regard to Wichita Lineman by Jim Webb.
Jimmy Webb.
Which we all know.
Program yesterday.
Yes, it's over here. We ought to check this with him. Which is, we all know, is the greatest song ever written, isn't it? Fact. It's a great song.
Almost indisputable.
Okay.
Apart from possibly...
here we go.
Yeah, This Charming Man by the Smiths. Oh, yes. But anyway, we haven't got time to discuss that. Though. Possibly the greatest song ever written. But go on. Oh, it's gone quiet. Listeners, the look of consternation and contempt lit up the features of David Hepworth is absolutely astonishing.
Anyway,
graphable.
I was persuaded by... Actually, Ian Rankin was joining in this Twitter debate about the precise meaning of Wichita Lineman. And I said, I'd like an electrical engineer to explain to me exactly what a Wichita Lineman is doing in the song. And somebody weighed in and said, oh, it's nothing to do with electrical engineering.
American football?
Very good. Very good.
Got that Wichita Lineman. She doesn't know the offside rule.
Yeah. Yes, related to Wichita tight end.
Yeah.
Another hits on the record. He said, no, it's to do with somebody clearing, moving overladen heavy goods vehicles off the highway. He sold me a whole line.
How would he explain the singing in the wires line?
Well, you can still look at the wires, can't you, while driving up and down. You can still hear the wires, you know. So I was persuaded of this for a while.
Did they mention the brake man?
Don't think the brake man. It's a different thing.
Go on.
And anyway, so for about an hour, this is what I thought. I thought Scales from Eyes, totally different song, you know. But it turns out he's wrong. Some guy's selling me a pop via Twitter, you know. So I've had two epiphanies yesterday. One, to be persuaded that it was all about overladen lorries. And then one, an hour later, to go back to where we started. So, you know, here he is. I'm a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road. Searching in the sun for another overload. Okay, so what are we saying he's doing, Fraser? Is he looking at the overhead power lines, or is he looking at the overhead telephone lines?
I don't know. I saw Jimmy Webb play live a few years ago, and he told the story of the song, and he described going on a car journey as a child and lying in the back seat and looking up at the telephone wires going either side of the car.
Yes, which you can imagine.
Yeah.
You can see that.
But I think he kind of works from a script and will probably tell you that it's about some kind of lines that he's seen.
You say he's, depending on the interview. He's a truck driver?
No. Well, I think where I...
A truck driver, an overload would mean an illegal load, wouldn't it?
Well, this is what my friend on Twitter was trying to persuade me, yes. Is it an overladen lorry?
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any sense, you know, that...
Because if
it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain.
He's referring to wires, though.
He's got to be referring to wires.
So right, because Willin points out the fact that the only way he could really make any money as a truck driver then, in the 1970s, was to drive on back roads with an overloaded truck so you wouldn't get weighed.
Because
you couldn't make enough money, in percentage-wise, by taking the legal weight on the back of
the
truck.
I'm sure it still is the case, probably, yeah. But so, you know, we're still open to people telling us. But I was reading then, I was trying to find out more about it, and Jimmy Webb was talking about how he wrote it, that it is the greatest song ever written.
Actually, is it the greatest song? I just thought another
one. You can come in with that and say, do you know how he wrote it?
We're not having a debate.
No, sky is blue, you know,
okay,
come on.
I've got a counter-argument.
That he wrote it when the publisher rang up and said, Glen Campbell needs a follow-up to By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Needs it tomorrow. And he was living the high life in Hollywood, and he had 30 people in the house having a kind of permanent all-day party. And he just went and shut himself in a room and sat there. He says, I know follow-ups. I know how follow-ups work. And he sat there and he wrote Wichita lineman.
Wow.
Under that kind of pressure. It's extraordinary.
You've got to give him some points.
It is. It's a fantastic song.
Highwayman by Jimmy Webb.
What, you're saying that's better?
It's phenomenal. I'm going to confess, I only heard anyone listening who hasn't heard Highwayman. There's a Glen Campbell version, there's several versions. There's also a new version by Arboretum, which is even better than the Glen Campbell version. And I think I didn't really concentrate.
Fighting talk.
It's just amazing. You know, four verses about, it's going to sound pretentious, I'm going to say it anyway, reincarnation.
Okay.
And the first verse is about the 18th century, second verse is the 19th century, third verse is the 20th, and the fourth verse is the 21st century. And there's only one word in each verse which locates it. Two actually, because one's about a highwayman. It talks about baubles, and the next verse is about a sailor. They use the word schooner, and the 20th century one is about a dam builder. It has the word concrete, which is brilliant, which clearly wouldn't have appeared in the other one. And the future verse is about a space pilot, and it uses the expression starship. I'll fly a starship across the universe divide. It is absolutely brilliant, and then it ends cyclically with the starship pilot. Thinking he will come back. All of them die. All of them die to the highwayman. Of course they die. What an absurd thing to say. The highwayman is killed. The bastards hung me in the spring of 45, where he's, but I'm still alive. So the idea that they'll all come back as something. And the starship pilot thinks he'll come back as a highwayman. So it's a brilliant little cycle back.
And we thought
that is a total.
Well, that's remarkable.
Card carrying masterpiece.
Well, I'm going to go and listen to it afterwards again.
My God, it's good.
We thought we'd said goodbye to that kind of thematic, you know, sophistication.
I was driving a car.
Precision.
I had to stop the car and listen to it again.
We thought it had gone, and then Noel Gallagher came along.
Don't spoil it. Don't puncture the balloon.
The Word. A magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
So we're back, and we're joined by Magic Alex Gold.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome, Magic.
Thank you.
Alex, is a triumphant week we've had this week. Alex, all down to you, Alex.
Oh, stop it.
Because
guys.
What Alex does, apart from put together the CDs that appear on the cover of every issue of Word, he also organises our string of Word in Your Ear gigs. Which take place at the Lexington, the pub across the road, because it's nearby, isn't it? And this week we had Wilco Johnson. Who else did we have?
A Genuine Freak Show and Alice Walker.
Right.
From Thaxted in Essex.
Describe the sound of those two support groups for those who may not be fully up to speed with their oeuvre.
Alice is a bit more like a more jaunty Kate Nash with better lyrics and some brass.
She's not hard to be jauntier than Kate Nash, is it?
She's quite jaunty or Nashy, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the Genuine Freak Show. Good name, I'm saying.
Very good name, yeah.
It is a good name.
I think Mark gave the best description ever of Genuine Freak Show, actually. Was, wasn't it Pink Floyd? And
I was rather embarrassed by that, actually.
Really?
I read that out and I didn't own up to it, but I said that it was something like sheets of Pink Floyd and Sigur Rós fed through the Radiohead filter.
That was it?
That's sad. Does that mean you believe it? I'd written that.
You make up quotes, then you read them as if it's just, I read this in the Times.
I introduced
such a good idea.
I did. I read that, actually, out. That's
some clown has written.
I should say it's some. I actually described it as some pretentious bloke's interest, but it was actually me. No, I was ashamed of it, but I thought it was worth saying because it gave you a bit of a handle on them. Because actually, I thought it was kind of true when I watched
and
them.
It's, very it was like quite accurate,
I thought. And they're very like Radiohead, and my God, they're like Sigur Rós. So, yes, tick, tick.
So there I was, up in my DJ booth, my eerie, my eagle's nest above the stage. Mm. And I was watching the proceedings unfold during the evening. And Alex has got the job that everybody would like, which is this. Which is, when he's worked out that the band have been on long enough, he just goes to the front of the stage, he stands in front of the singer, and he holds up one finger.
Just says, sling your hook.
which means one to go.
Yeah.
And I thought, wouldn't life be great if you could do that, you know, with every gig you went to? Just went along. You've delighted us long enough. One tune to go.
But maybe you should be in on the podcast every time, actually. We need someone like that. Say, guys, this literally, we've heard this before.
Now, you did that with the two support groups.
Yeah.
You didn't do it with Wilco Johnson.
Yeah, He did do.
I think he had frantic consultation with the manager. I didn't see him walk in front of Wilco and go. I think Wilco's eye would have been somewhat difficult to catch.
Watch impatiently.
Anyway, it was Wilco Johnson, accompanied by, if that's an adequate term to describe what Norman Watroy provided on the bass, the man who used to play bass, who still does play bass for the Blockheads. And I was even more amazed by Dylan Howe, the drummer, who compared to Wilco Johnson and Norman Watroy is a mere slip of a boy, isn't it? But he's probably in his 40s.
Terrific state of preservation.
And he's a fantastic drummer, perfect for the sound of Wilco Johnson. And, of course, what I couldn't believe the day after is I looked up Dylan Howe, and he's now on tour with his jazz quartet. Have you seen this?
I haven't, no.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely... He tours with a proper jazz quartet, playing the most,
Just any drummer that good could just play any kind of music, can't they? I mean, that's...
That came as a bit of a surprise to me, because he played the drums like somebody who'd just only ever played that kind of thing in his life.
Yeah, no element of jazz. Well, mind you, if there was, he would have been killed twice by the other two members
of the band. Except the solo was pretty, Bill Bruford or a member of the Grateful Dead wouldn't have even recognised that as a solo.
I thought it was a fill. To Kate Moss, when I was standing next to her, said jazz, and she went back, yes, jazz.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, okay, but it was about 12 seconds long, wasn't it?
I printed off this thing. I liked it so much. In the front row of the concert, clearly identifiable in a lot of the pictures, was the great Captain Underpants.
Yes.
To anybody listening who's not aware, I'm sure you are, is a very, very regular, very colourful, very entertaining poster upon our site, and a key member of the Massive. And Underpants filed this poster, which I thought was so... I'm thinking of printing it, actually, in the magazine. He says, this is when the group comes, he says, when he launches, Wilco, he says, when he launches a solo, his whole body spasms taut, and he faints right before lurching off across the stage to his left. It's a huge jolt of energy for a teenager, let alone a gentleman in his 60s. As for Norman, there's something feral about him. This is Norman Watroy, the bass player of the Blockheads and various other things. He said, it's like he's been let out of a cage for the show. Yeah. Which is true. He said he can navigate previously uncharted routes around a 12-bar pattern, sometimes wandering so far from both the root and the rhythm that you fear he'll never get back. And once or twice, with a snarl from those destroyed teeth, which Dylan Howe clearly recognises as a smile, he doesn't. Which is really, really, really good description, isn't it?
They were fantastic. They were extraordinary. I saw Dr. Feelgood, I was working this out afterwards, in 1975 at what was then called the Holloway Poly, that is now the University of North London. And it was the Naughty Rhythms tour, which means they were with Kokomo and Chilli Willy and the Red Hot Peppers. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Feelgood had been a big hit, and so they were a headliner. And they were great. They weren't as good as Wilco Johnson was the other night, because the rhythm section of Dr. Feelgood were not as good as Wilco Johnson's rhythm section is.
But
I thought it was extraordinary. You know, this guy, what is he, 64, 65?
Yeah.
I thought he was absolutely remarkable.
I just love the way that the Freak Show were a seven-piece and had this amazing wall of sound, and they were absolutely brilliant. They blew everybody's heads off, and then Wilco came on with a three-piece band, was even louder, and blew everybody else.
And also very detailed as well. It was very filled.
It was.
So much going on.
And I couldn't see, again from my vantage point, I couldn't see a set list anywhere on the stage, which seemed to indicate that they only knew what to play
when Wilco started playing the intro.
Which
all the intros were exactly the same.
Must be like being a member of the Ink Spots. Right, you could do any tune without intro.
Same chords, maybe didn't matter.
He was fantastic. From Drakey Girl has tweeted this. She said, she was there. She said, I couldn't see Wilco's feet from my vantage point. Can you confirm my suspicion that he was on casters?
It looks like, actually, of course, he moves his... I can't demonstrate this on a podcast, but he does the kind of V shape thing where you heel to toe.
And
he just scoots across invisibly. It's absolutely incredible.
And when I was watching them set up, of course, Genuine Freak Show and the group before, Alice Band, everybody's got so much kit nowadays, Alex. You know, you must give us an insight into this from you play with the Wootars, who've done a couple of these gigs before. Everybody's got pedals and special effects and all this. And suddenly, before Wilco came on, the stage was just effectively cleared. And I thought, they haven't got anything here at all. There's just the drum kit, there's a couple of mics, and then there's a huge space. And obviously, they just clear that space because he has no pedals or anything. And they just have to have enough room for him to do his mad Clockwork Mouse you know,
but that's,
rush
that's
across
their
the
idea
stage.
Of effects, isn't it? That's their effects equivalent, is a bloke lurching across the stage and machine gunning the audience.
Yeah, the old thing.
The old trick, just makes this rat-a-tat sound. It's absolutely fantastic.
Also, curly lead. It's a good thing to see.
Yes! Has everybody stopped with the curly lead? That's what I was thinking. I was watching them and thinking, did the men's before have curly leads? Did they, Alex?
They had resolutely straight leads.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Right,
these are the burning issues that we thrash out on the podcast.
I tell you, the other thing that struck me was watching the audience coming in. There ought to be a word for the activity that is blokes of any age, actually, who've been to loads of rock gigs. When they come in to a place like that, they're the first ones in, a bunch of them go near the stage, and what do? They look at the equipment.
I was standing with Alex. We were just talking about effects pedals, weren't we?
At one point, she said to Alex,
"How's he making that noise?"
No, but this was before musicians came at all. They were just looking at the kit.
I do that.
They're trying to assess what kind of experience they were going to get from the kit.
I still do that. If I go to see a group, I think we might have talked about this on podcast before, but if I go to see a group and I don't know who they are, I will go and look at the kit and I try and imagine who will be occupying that slot.
Yes, yeah.
That must be a backing singer. That's a flute. Oh, okay, flute and then mandolin. Okay, so you have a mental, so they play the flute and the mandolin, they're going to be dressed like this.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's fantastic.
There was a brilliant post on the, I think maybe put there by you after the concert, there's a picture of Kate Mossman, myself, giving out the raffle prize.
Oh, yes.
And it's just us shot from behind in a blue light. You just see the silhouette of an enormous pineapple.
Yeah.
And the caption says something like, Kate Mossman and Mark Ellen giving a lucky prize winner from Slough a pineapple.
He didn't want it, but we made him take it.
Retro man who came up to me actually afterwards with his pineapple, clutching his pineapple, and said, thanks so much. I watched him walk off down the street. Clutching the pineapple with just overfilled with happiness.
So that's word in your.
It's a nine out.
You come out with a pineapple and a goldfish.
Well, Il Hombre, we came all the way from Scotland, actually, bizarrely, won a can of Scotch broth. So there's an irony for you.
I think he left it in the cloakroom. Don't feel too bad about it.
Fair enough.
So is that word in your ear number four or number three? I can't remember.
Number three.
So previously we've had the Divine Comedy and we've had Pugwash. Who are we having next, Alex? You don't know yet, do you?
Who knows? It's a book at the moment.
Okay, right. But what we're trying to do is have a kind of varied bill of fare, isn't it, with these things? You know, so we don't want them all the same.
The next one will probably have a slightly different vibe to this one, just to keep it fresh.
Good, absolutely.
But it was a big success. And it's all down to you, Alex. The other thing Alex does is put together the CDs. New issue of Word comes out next week. Subscribers will probably be getting their copies this weekend. What are they going to find on the CD? I see you've got Ron Sexsmith.
We have.
Kicking off with Ron Sexsmith. I have to say, this is, I think, the best Ron Sexsmith record I've ever heard.
And, nowhere near as mannered as some of his other ones.
I think it's rather, very often in the past I found it a bit insipid.
Well,
it's punchy now.
Cheesecake factor. It's very rich, isn't it? It's like listening to Rufus Wainwright. There's only so much you can take.
Whereas this one's produced by Bob Rock. Who's Bob Rock, Fraser? Isn't he kind of metal producer? Didn't he produce Metallica? So you're supposed to know this.
If Bob Rock was not a metal producer, I'd want to know why.
Yeah. Who else?
He's doing the new
Who else is on this?
We've got Gruff Rhys from Super Furry Animals.
Oh, nice.
He's coming with a very, very smooth number called Vitamin K. We've also got Patrick Campbell Lyons, who is in the original proper Nirvana.
The proper Nirvana, who's also written, he's written a book, hasn't he? Written his memoirs, which is apparently quite good. I haven't read those myself.
And we've got Matt Berry, who's Sanchi in Dark Place. He's come out with some piano-led folk, which is very, very good, actually.
There's Matt Berry, who specialises in pastiches of Old Grey Whistle Test on YouTube,
right.
Which he's threatened to try and get me and Mark involved in. We're still waiting for a call on that.
What does he do? He just introduces bands in a kind of earnest way?
Yes, in a darkened studio, smoking a cigarette on a kind of swivel chair.
Oh, that's funny.
Anything else you want to mention?
He played in a Word in Europe, actually, the first one.
Yes, he's backing vocals with Pugwash.
He's a mate of that.
Yeah, I met him in the pub with Pugwash.
Yeah, really nice chap. We've also got the Wigs, who are kind of fuzzy indie rock from America.
Now, is this the Wigs with an H?
It is, yes.
This
the
is
Wigs.
The Wigs.
Mm. Liberal Democrats.
No.
as we call them over here.
But that's probably my favourite track, actually. He's got a really, really dirty bass line, and I've got a weakness for those kinds of things. What else have we got? We've got John Watts, who was in a band called Fisher Zed.
Oh my God, they all come back. Fisher Zed.
They had an album called Word Salad Surgery, I think, which sounds very like brain salad.
Oh, really?
I think so.
They're on New Zealand United Artists.
I remember meeting Fluff Freeman once, and he was wearing a satin tour jacket with the words Fisher Zed, with the legend Fisher Zed.
I'm sure Fluff had probably had an entire wardrobe made up of, of satin tour jackets. Did you ever have a satin tour jacket?
Not that I ever wore, no. No, I might have been given one. I've been given a few things, merchandise things, but I've then spent ages picking off the name of the band from the epaulette or whatever.
Whereas nowadays you probably regret that.
No,
because you can knock out for a fortune on eBay.
Absolutely right.
I was flying somewhere recently, and the guy had
a pair of Bram Tchaikovsky's battle axe underpants.
The guy in a queue ahead of me checking had a set of Iron Maiden luggage.
Good God!
I think it must have been like he was pretty work for them or something.
I can say he didn't actually go and buy Iron Maiden luggage. Yeah. Dear, oh dear. Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Alex. That's the CD on the cover of the new issue, which, as I say, will be with subscribers this weekend.
Should be this weekend.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
So I was playing this record yesterday and really enjoying it. Thought it's very good. But all I was thinking was this. If you made a sound as appealing as this, why would you go out under the unappealing name of Joan as Policewoman? Why would
you? I thought you were going to say that.
Why would you give yourself that handicap? You know, only in pop music are people allowed to do anything as kind of contrary as that. I can't believe that her route through what is always a challenging path in pop and rock is going to be in any way eased by the fact that she's called Joan as Policewoman. But I mean, even Joan, if she just called herself Joan is quite striking, because nobody else called Joan, really, is there?
No.
You know, you wouldn't be mistaken for anybody else. But Joan as Policewoman. You know, there must be a bunch of people who, I mean, I know record shops are going, but, you know, in the old days... One of the key elements of the kind of commercial growth was, were people prepared to walk into record shops and actually say your name to somebody behind the counter? And if you're called Jonas Policewoman, it's twice as hard than if you're called Led Zeppelin.
But there are bands who seem to get by with these kind of names that are more like sentences than their names. I've got three examples of bands who've done okay, which is Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, done okay. Get Cape, Wear Cape, Fly, done okay. And does it offend you? Yeah.
Does it offend you, comma, yeah.
But I've discovered, I just...
At least the two, in their defence, those are punchy.
Okay.
Clap Hands, Say Yeah is punchy.
Try these off the side.
Oh, go on.
These are real band names. Everyone was in the French Resistance now.
Everyone was.
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, see me.
Slap.
Could do better.
The Bewitched Hands on the Top of Our Heads.
Oh,
you're just being silly.
Honey?
The scattered remains of a more glorious past.
I quite like that.
I'm just trying to imagine what they look like. I can see army fatigues.
Who are you going to
hair extensions?
Somebody will have a beard.
Someone's got a beard.
Yeah. The slowest runner in the world.
That's a terrible... That's awful.
Oh, that's just...
Not even John Peel would say, you know, two more in session from them later, would he?
Everything you've ever known is a piece of light. That's a real band.
That's a real band. Is that, do they exist now? Yeah. Or just only in legend?
Yeah. Here we go. The world is a beautiful place, and I am no longer afraid to die.
Another way of phrases. I love his intonation. I'm afraid to die. There's a certain amount of drama at the end, isn't there?
One more.
Oh, one more.
Destroy, rebuild until God shows.
That's quite good.
You see, is there a theory, Fraser, you're a man who knows about the internet. There is a theory, isn't there, nowadays, that the best name you can have on the internet is something that won't be confused with anything else.
Well, that's true.
Like Google or,
I think that works with single words. The minute you put eight together, unless you're writing speech quotes.
Yeah.
Oh, right, so you're more likely to find a thread to that group if it's got nine words in the title.
No, less likely.
Because it'll get confused with loads of other things.
Oh, I see.
Whereas if you just call one word, if you call Google or Amazon... You won't be mistaken.
But I have a theory that now we're obviously into band names which are formed of long sentences. the next obvious step will be to have band names which are formed of a series of sentences.
Paragraphs.
And the one I've come up with, which I think is good, this will be like a left field indie band, is, look, there's a biplane. Where? Over there.
Behind you.
Yeah. Oh,
the thing that confused me, I've just picked up randomly five records which came in, all came in yesterday, I think. They're brand new records, right? And I brought them in here. And I'll posit a new theory, which is that it used to be very easy when you looked at the record to tell what the name of the group was, yeah, what the name of their album, yeah, was, right? Yeah. The group was called, you know, the Swinging Blue Jeans or whatever it was, and the album was called, you know, Love is a Battlefield or something like that, right? Well, look, let me try these out. Here's five records, okay? In Flight Safety, We Are an Empire, My Dear.
So we don't know which is the title.
I actually can't tell from that. Which is, in fact, I haven't.
And they will also be designed by somebody's boyfriend.
Yeah, here's another one, right? Okay, this is either a group or an album called Left With Pictures. It's either a group or an album called In Time. Mm. But I don't know which is a group called In Time. This is Dead Rock West with Brighter Morning Star.
I think they're called Dead Rock West.
Now, this is what I mean. Look, this is classic, right? This, I actually know the answer to this. The group is called Within Temptation, but the album's called The Unforgiving.
Oh,
then normally you'd think The Unforgiving with the name. What's happened to rock and roll, Fraser?
I don't know.
Why should we stand for this?
But Within Temptation is a terrible name.
It's a disgrace, really. But I mean, I'm sure it's a very good record, and I shall listen to it. But I mean, none of these are as bad as the worst names ever. Of course, which are, as you know, U2 and the Beatles. Not a discussion, just a statement of fact. And the best names ever, I think. REM, obviously, the best name of any group ever, I think. We're talking about them again, aren't we? Magical. Brilliant, sure, fabulous, and then when you find out what it means, even more magical. But I think proper good names were things like Dr. Strangely Strange, because he knew exactly what you were going to get.
Never a podcast goes by without him mentioning Dr. Strangely Strange.
Oh, they've got a big string band.
They deserve to be mentioned.
It's like, Clive Dunn.
It's a great name.
I was sent one this week, and I had to... I'm a moderately educated, well-read person, and I had to ask Kate, and you, I think, how to pronounce it, because I wasn't sure.
Go on.
This group's called, The, and then their name is R-E-C-U-S-A-N-T-S. You've got to write it down again.
I'm going to have to write
everybody,
it down.
Everybody out there in Podland, write this down. R-E-C...
R-E-C.
U-S-A-N-T-S.
My pen isn't working. Recusants.
Right, well, recusants. I think it's the recusants.
Recusants.
But this is a religious sect who refused to embrace the Church of England in the, I think, 17th century. I mean, I had heard of... I'd actually heard of the word before, but I still didn't know... how to pronounce it.
So that's a tradition of being called the Levellers or the Decembrists, which you're a kind of or the New Model Army.
But why would you pick something? You know, why would you pick something that's so difficult for people? You know, because if people don't know how to say it, they'll avoid saying it.
It's so much easier to be called Get Cape, Wear Cape, Fly.
Yeah, Get Cape, Wear Cape, Fly. I'll forgive. Yeah. So we'll finish with a few more questions from The Massive, which come in on Twitter. Some very good ones. HB Wonderful. Which modern band is suited to a Roger Dean cover? That's a good one.
Good God. Well, in terms of their name? Golden Messenger? No.
I think they're Dutch, Bank of the Flower Kings, who sound exactly like Yes, so they'll be on.
Oh, OK, right. I can imagine a Decembrist record packaged in a Roger Dean
cover. No, because the Decembrists are set in the past, though, aren't they? And Roger Dean's set in the future.
Oh, OK. Well,
right, Decembrists are all set in the 18th century, aren't they?
From Lenny Law, power pop is the great lost musical genre. True.
Good Lord.
Apart from its practitioners mainly being bloody ugly, why should this be? Now, I have to take issue with Lenny on this.
Fair.
I don't think they're all...
What is pop? Is that the Jags? What is that?
Suppose power pop... Power pop dates back to about 1978, doesn't it? When it was the Knack and you know, the Nerves and so forth, and the Records. It was generally groups who played jangly guitars, had collars with a kind of tightly studded through there and a tie. Very often wore the sleeves of their...
Rubettes?
Thin ties.
Jags.
Yeah. Rubettes, you see, could never possibly qualify for power pop for one important reason, which is, I think, what Lenny's referring to. They had hits.
Oh,
whereas power pop groups don't have hits. You know, there's records come out all the time. You know, it sounds a little bit like Tom Petty, sounds a bit like the Byrds, got 12-string guitar on it, you know, glistening harmonies, all the usual clichés.
Simon Boswell and Top Taylor's advertising.
And then like nobody buys them. Nobody buys their records,
no,
do they?
No.
They just, so we haven't got a reason, we haven't got a theory as to why. Okay.
He's absolutely
but
right.
You're absolutely right, yeah. Lenny. Okay. Whole Hog throws in this, and I think this is the, he's been throwing a number of dilemmas
it's
at
Whole Hog
us.
Who threw in, in fact, he sent me an email this morning saying he was about to throw something in.
I think he's going to throw I think he's going to throw a major bomb in the podcast here.
I throw Cavalier
right?
About his Ivor Cutler versus Viv Stanch.
This
ludicrous.
This one could result
time,
in...
Deliberate time wasting.
This one could result in a fist fight. You know, we're going to become a big graphical symbol with a boot coming out of it and a cloud and so forth. So he wants to
like
know.
Handicap getting
he wants
his
to know. Yarrow, ouch. He wants to know. Incredible String Band.
Oh, that's
all.
That's low.
Or Fairport Convention. Incredible String Band or Fairport Convention.
But you can't compare them.
Oh,
it's not a fair question.
Oh, he's wriggling.
That's what, as they would say in political debates, illegal question. Illegal. No, you can't compare them. They're, because they are both absolutely kings of their own particular castles, aren't they?
Okay.
They're not in the same area at all. See, one is Mystic Celtic Folk, man, and the other's the Fairport Convention, isn't it? You know. Yes. So that's the end of that
that's
one.
That's the answer to all the
give
questions.
Me another,
yes,
give me
the other is Fairport Convention.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's very good. We've wriggled out of that one.
Yeah.
Russell 1234, will cassettes ever make a comeback like records?
No.
They won't, will they?
No.
Not possible.
They have no... There's nothing cherishable about a cassette.
If they were going to come back, why would you still see them dangling from brambles alongside the A303? just tattered and...
Very good, very good. Baskerville, Old F. Which albums do you think sounded best through headphones? Back in the day, I assume he's referring to. And any modern albums that really stand out? Because I think I've talked in the past on this podcast about... I used to have a copy of Stonehenge by 10 Years After.
Oh, brilliant record.
Which was one of the first stereo records. No, not a brilliant record.
Oh, I loved them.
Bloody wretched record.
No, I mean, a classic
but anyway,
work from the Henge, from the after, sorry.
which had, in order to demonstrate the stereo, the drummer playing Three Blind Mice on the drums. So, you know, panning straight across, you know. It also had one track which had a train going from one side to the other. So those are the glory days of headphones, as far as I'm concerned.
So it could be used to, as a kind of demonstration.
Yeah, demonstration record. The other one that I remember... loving on headphones was Michael Nesmith, pretty much your standard ranch stash.
Oh, yeah.
Second Side Of, which is a trilogy, which fantastic cover. Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful cover.
Winking?
He was winking, yeah, yeah, yeah. Are there any modern albums that stand out for headphones?
I've never been a headphone listener, but go back to what you said earlier. I like an album of Trains, I think, to listen to on headphones.
Oh, there are many of those.
Yeah.
There's a roaring trade done in train sounds. Probably all gone on the internet.
Just for recreational reasons?
No, train spots.
It's not stereo, going from side to side.
Yeah,
your
head.
That's supposed to be like
fun. So do you ever listen to anything on headphones, Mark, at home? Do you ever go home?
Not really, no. We've got the old vinyl system up.
Oh, I got mine out again last week.
So I'm just constantly going through. I'm really getting a lot of fun out of it, actually. Going through and getting my old, records out the roof and dusting them down, and it's marvellous.
I played last weekend, and I came to one conclusion. There goes Rhyming Simon by Paul Simon. It's an absolute bloody masterpiece.
And is it as good as Highwayman by Jimmy Webb or This Charming Man? But this is where we came
I think
in.
Kodachrome is a great, great song.
No, just the cyclical nature of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to fade out
and
with
finally,
the sound of, you know,
and finally,
cudgels at
last
the
question. Tim Turner Books. Don't know if you call that, Tim. He says, I just finished Juliet Naked. Is that Nick Hornby book? I think it is.
Yes, I think so.
He says, who is the most believable rock star or band in fiction? And it's interesting that you should say this, Tim, because in the new issue of Word,
yes,
which comes out
perfect.
Next week, unless you're wise enough to subscribe, in which case you'll
probably get a copy
this weekend, the best and worst in the issue is actually worst fictional musicians in all entertainment and best fictional musicians. And the one that I'm personally most... convinced by recently, Tim, is I read Jonathan Franzen's novel Freedom, and he's got a character in there called Richard Katz, who's really interesting character in that he starts off a failure and then he becomes a cult success, you know, so he becomes a kind of Nick Cave figure or something like that in middle age. And a lot of the plot of the book revolves around how he attempts to exploit this celebrity. But I really like that creation of that character, because it's not an obvious rock star character. Yeah, because rock star characters are usually either immense superstars, which you can never quite be convinced about, because you think, wouldn't I have heard of them? Or they're complete failures.
Yeah.
Whereas this one is in the middle. You know, it's really, really well drawn. And final question, Scarlet Lobster, and this is a bit of a difficult one to answer off the top of your head, has anybody except Clifford T. Ward ever used the word nonpareil in a song?
Did he?
Yes, he did.
Did he?
He did. We were looking at the words this week. Extraordinary, very sophisticated wordplay all the way through that. Because he was an English teacher, wasn't he?
I don't even know what the word means.
Well, it means without equal. Without
parallel.
I thought
you were say you'd never heard of Clifford T. Ward. In which case, we really would have a problem.
That would be terrible.
Yeah.
The great pioneer of the tank top in pop.
He was.
Clifford T. Ward. Sadly, no longer with us.
No longer with us. And, again, yards of non-centre-parted, unconditioned hair. Never a major poster boy, was he, Clifford? I don't think.
Well, I think
although,
so.
Seemed to have a bit of attraction with girls who lived in bedsits. I remember going to see my sister once when she lived in a bedsit, and she had a Clifford T. Ward record, and she also had Al Stewart, several records by Al Stewart.
Love Chronicles.
Tea for the Tiller Man.
Cat Stevens.
Oh, it's been a long day. Cat Stevens, for Christ's sake. You're right.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word. Details at wordmagazine.co.uk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.